So thank you guys so much for joining me. I'm just going to gonna be a real a yeki, right? We're gonna start on time, and I want to say that our learning tonight is dedicated. Of course, any Torah that we learn is dedicated towards soldiers fighting in Gaza and preparing in the north, and also with our tefillah for the last, our prayer for the last 40 days, which is a speedy, healthy return of all hostages, and they should come and they should be returned in full health and back to their families as quickly as possible. That's really the main amen, right? That's the main thing on our minds. That's what we've been praying for, what we've been davening for, and what we hope happens very, very soon. And I wrote at the top of the poster when we made this, I said that this was actually a response to a number of people to do something like this from the school. I forgot to start recording. In response to a request that I got a beautiful email from a parent. And the parent said, you know, thank you so much for open school night. It was outstanding. And it was so great to hear what our students are learning, what our kids are learning in school. And then the parent said that they recognize that their kids are already more advanced than they are in their Jewish education. And they said, we want our conversations around the family table, we want our conversations to be conversations that are centered around what our kids are doing. And that means that we weren't the beneficiaries. I'm just going to, as we grow a little bit, I'm just going to mute everybody, but you could certainly unmute yourselves at will. If you have a question, you could raise your hand. It's been, you know, there was used to be a time that we used this platform so much and we became so adept at it. Thank God we're able to meet much more in person nowadays. Dr. Ostroff, you certainly remember those meetings as well. You know, so they said that we want our conversations with our kids to be level, and we were not the beneficiaries of a Jewish education, something that we're able to provide for our kids now. So teach us, instead of something advanced, it says something that dives very deep into text, that sets a number of bars to entry for people. We want to have some background. We want to have some common conversation with our students who are now benefiting from the joy of a Jewish education. So that's the point of this class, is to serve as really an appetizer. This is not meant to be exhaustive. It's not meant to be something that covers every detail. There are going to be things that I will be of necessity leaving out that we won't be covering. But hopefully after the next five classes in this, including the one tonight, you will have at least a rudimentary open understanding of, and I'll show you what we intend to discuss and learn, but a rudimentary understanding of the backgrounds of a Jewish education. And I said, now more than ever, one of the things that really has been getting me a lot lately is that the most powerful response we have, I think, to what we are seeing now, the explosion of anti-Semitism, the explosion, you know, there's this window of things that you can say, that you're allowed to, that are part of the discourse, the Overton window, I think it's called. And we're watching it get shattered, really, on college campuses, in our streets, in what politicians, elected politicians, even in our country are saying, and in abroad. It's quite scary, and there's a lot of anxiety, and I keep on telling people, and smart people are telling me the way to channel that anxiety about what's going on and feeling of helplessness is to do things, and people have been doing things, been getting involved in acts of loving kindness, of chesed. They've been getting involved in all kinds of community initiatives. Many of us, we took two buses to Washington yesterday of our students. We had an amazing day, a day that students, it was so special to watch kids develop core memories. I remember when I was in eighth grade and we marched on Washington in 2002. And it was during the Second Intifada, and something I still remember. You watch students wide-eyed at the screens and the crowds that they saw yesterday. Now, in addition to all those things, I'm a Jewish teacher, I'm a Jewish educator, and I firmly believe that one of the best and most important forms of action is connecting deeply to your Judaism, learning more about your Judaism, learning what it is to be a Jew. What are we proud of? What kind of history are we proud of? What kind of teachings and what kind of learning are we proud of to the world? And that's the point of the class. So I'm going to, without much further ado, we're going to jump into it, and I'm going to share my screen with you guys, and I'm going to try my best to manage this all. You know, back in the days where the CCE was in its full bloom, so somebody would manage the waiting room also. So I apologize if I'll be interrupting to allow people in. So this is called Go and Learn, 5-part introduction to Judaism. And every Hebrew term, every concept that I mention, I will be translating into English as well. And I'll be speaking in the vernacular, but if you have any questions, my email is here. It's also available on the school website. I want this to be a conversation. What I do intend to do is to provide all materials, make it available through an email to the school community, and also to provide, hopefully, reading lists and further learning for everybody. So let's begin. So the first class I want to talk about from Mesopotamia to Manhattan, a class title in Shul's and in Jewish education always needs to have a nice alliterative title with a colon after it also. I've accomplished that here. Mesopotamia to Manhattan, a brief history of Judaism. Tonight, in the next 35 minutes or so, we are going to do a crash course in all of Jewish history. Hopefully we manage to make it there. We're going to talk about before Sinai, before the giving of the Torah, the creation, the flood, the patriarchs and matriarchs, the descent to Egypt, the greatest story ever told. We'll touch upon the Exodus. We're going to talk about the revelation of the Torah at Sinai. And then after Sinai, the wandering in the desert, the conquest and division of the land of Israel. We'll also talk about the period of the judges. Following that, the period of kings. After that, we'll talk about the destruction and the building of the two temples, all the way into diaspora, the beginnings of the Jewish diaspora into Babylonia and beyond, and to Byzantium at the time. And we'll also talk about the Lachmaros view of Jewish history, which is the Crusades, the Inquisition, the pogroms, wandering again, and the expulsions that our people have been through. And then we'll make our way into modernity. Modernity, its discontents, Jewish movements, messianic movements, false messiahs, spiritual movements, the Enlightenment, the emancipation of Jews. And then we'll finally make our way. We'll talk a little bit about the Shoah, the destruction of European Jewry, and hopefully get our way all the way into the 21st century. I know it's a tall order. I'm going to try and speak not so fast. Sometimes when I get excited, I speak a little bit faster than I would like to. But let's begin. The first thing that I need to say is that our learning history, although it might seem that we're talking about history, the truth is that it's a religious imperative for Jews to learn their history and to learn world history. The first source on the side over here, the Hebrew is there, but I'll just read in English. It says, "Remember the days of old, consult the years of many generations, ask thy father, and he will declare unto thee," mothers also are included in this, "thine elders, and they will tell thee." S'chor yom o'salam, we have a mitzvah to remember our history, to remember and to understand what has happened to the Jewish people. Zechor itself has become a byword. Remember is a byword for Holocaust remembrance, for this line. There were a lot of signs. I thought we said never again. I thought that's what happened. Understanding what it was that can't happen again is really important. And then also the Talmud records that that Adam, there's a tradition that the first man was shown. The Torah is called Zeh Sefer Toldota Adam. This is the book of the generations of man, of Adam. What that means is that God also exposed the first human being, the first created people, to all of history, show them everything that would happen in every generations. And interestingly enough, it includes the story of Rabbi Akiva, who suffered immensely, who was tortured for the teaching of Torah and for the dissemination of Torah and for his own Torah. And it was so terrible that even Moses, when he was talking about Rabbi Akiva, when he saw the punishment that Rabbi Akiva had endured for teaching Torah, for daring to do so, he exclaimed against God and said, how could this be the reward of Torah? So interspersed with our history, interspersed with the generations and the miracle of Judaism is a tremendous amount of wandering and suffering. Mark Twain, I think, once said that all things are mortal except the Jew. All things are mortal except the Jew. That nations, empires come and go, and yet we are still here in 2023 Still telling many of the same stories, enduring things, I think for the first time for many of us, enduring things in some, our own small way that our ancestors endured. But this is the immortality of Jewish people. The greatest miracle, I think, available to us nowadays is the very fact of our survival. That's the greatest miracle and something that we could hold on strong to. I wrote in this past week's bicultural newsletter, the Dvar Torah, that I share every week. I wrote that in times where you struggle with faith, where I struggle with faith, that sooner than turning to God, or before I turned to God, I turned to my grandparents, Holocaust survivors, people who saw the founding of the State of Israel and witnessed it with their own eyes. That's what animates my faith. And we all are part of this chain. And before we look at this timeline, I'll quote Rabbi Herschel Shafter, who is a Rosh Yeshiva at YU, and my Rebbe, learned for 5 years under his tutelage, amongst many others. I was not special. But recently in an interview, they asked him, you know, this is a person who issues halachic decisions of the Jewish law for thousands of people. And his word carries tremendous weight. And they asked him, they said, you know, how would you like to be remembered? What is it that you want to be remembered? And he says, what I want to be remembered is that I didn't break the chain, that I was a link in the chain, that it didn't end with me. And everybody here, parents, grandparents, children, that we all are links in those chains. And it's a powerful charge. It's a powerful mission to not break the chain. And you have here a timeline of everything that we're going to be essentially covering tonight in this thumbnail sketch. We have the creation of the world, the birth of Noah. We have the flood, the birth of Abraham, binding of Isaac, all the way up to these generations. In fact, I'm going to skip this because we'll come back to it later. But I should note that you may have heard or you may see sometimes that people give the age of the world as 5,784. This year is Tufshin Pei Dalet, sorry. 5,784. What I would say is that's not a scientific age of the universe. Science tells us that the universe is actually billions of years old. But we think about it from the Torah's chronology, the Torah's creation of the world, which starts in the beginning in Bereshit. So we have here the 6 days of creation. The Torah starts off with giving us a cosmology, a story about the creation of the world. We have the creation of light and the separation of light and darkness on the first day. We have in the second day, the separation of the waters, of the upper waters, the clouds, and the atmosphere, and the lower waters, the oceans. Finally, we have dry land and the emergence of vegetation. Then we have on the fourth day, the Torah describes, oh my goodness, Sophia, can you please bring Judah back to bed? I'm sorry, guys. Judah, you must go back into bed, my love. You must go back into bed. I'm sorry, I'm home alone. My wife was... My wife is at a meeting in the city all day. so welcome to my home. He comes down in a Spider-Man costume. He's not supposed to do that. I apologize for that. On the fourth day is the creation of the celestial spheres. On the fifth day, the birds and the fish of the ocean. And on the sixth day, on what is Erev Shabbat, on the first Friday. So the first Friday has the creation of land animals, and right before Shabbat is the creation of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, are created right before the entrance to Shabbat. A lot happens before that time because Adam and Eve are created, and they, in a very human way, they're told, don't do this, right? You tell a child, don't come out of your room, you know, please stay in bed. I thought I put you to sleep hours ago. but when you... when you are told not to do that one thing, Adam and Eve do just that. They eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That itself is an entirely wondrous episode, shrouded in mystery. And because of that, they're banished from the Garden of Eden. And we find that the curse that they endure, the punishment that they endure, is a punishment that resonates for all of human history, namely, Bezeat Apecha Tocha Lechem. Things are not going to be easy. By the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread. Finally, there's the day that God rested, is the Sabbath. That's why Sabbath, as I would say, one of the primary commandments of Judaism, which we'll get to later on in a different class. One of the primary commandments of Judaism is actually not just necessarily a day of rest, but it's a constructive rest. It's a rest that seals in, bakes in all of the aspects of creation that happened on the previous 6 days. And when we make Kiddush, when we sanctify wine, we bless the wine both on Friday night and on Saturday morning. The blessing of the wine is one that mentions not necessarily the Sabbath, but mentions, more importantly, centers the creation of the universe. After the creation, humanity more or less carried on for 10 generations. There's the first murder of Cain and Abel. And God declares to Noah, he says, "Ki yetzer lev ha'adam rak ra minu rav." A sad assessment of human nature, that the heart of human beings, the heart of people is bad. We have evil within us. We have the capacity for evil. We're endowed with choice. We're endowed with the ability to make moral choices. And oftentimes, as human history is borne out, and as we see nowadays, human beings do not make moral choices. We fail often in our charge to be moral, in our charge to strive towards divinity, towards something higher. And that is part of the curse. And God decides that because v'timalei ha'aretz chamas, the world is filled with petty violence, God brings a flood. He tells Noah and his family that they should go into an ark, they should save in the ark the animals, kosher, non-kosher, and just Noah and his family survive. 10 generations from Noah, you have an individual. And I'm moving to the second image over here. You have an individual by the name of Avram, or Abram. And his name is later changed. The Hebrew letter hey is added to it. And he's called Avraham. And Avraham is married at first to Sarai, who is his wife, eventually becomes Sarah. And they bear no children initially. And Hagar, Avraham's second wife, his concubine, gives birth to Ishmael, to Yishmael. Finally, Avraham and Sarah have a son, Isaac. And Isaac marries Rebecca. It shouldn't be eliminated from the story of the Torah that Isaac is bound. God commands Avraham, commands him to take his one son, his only son, his precious son, to bring him up to be sacrificed. The paradox of the command is immense. I'll stop sharing just to be able to look at you all. But the paradox of the commandment is so immense, because everything that Abraham had been fighting against his entire life was idolatry, was child sacrifice, was the denigration of the value of human life. And here he is, after he's recognized God, after he's forged a covenant with God, and God tells him to do just that. And not just that, but that the son that was promised to be his legacy, that son is the one that that's going to be eliminated over here. And yet Abraham, and this is some see this as the penultimate, or some see it as the ultimate of Abraham's test. Abraham decides to go along with it. And at the very last moment, an angel stays his hand. This Akedah, this binding of Isaac, is something that I think this paradoxical, wild, wild story in the Torah. We read it a few weeks. I feel like we should spend a whole year just on that parsha, because there's so much to talk about. But that is something that seems to stand in our stead for the Jewish people for all of our history. This very notion of being almost slaughtered, of being almost wiped out, of being almost completely knocked away and our legacy completely erased, and yet somehow passing the test, somehow going beyond it. Abraham and Sarah have a son, Isaac. Isaac marries Rebecca, and they have, and I know I'm moving quickly over here, and again, this is not meant to be exhaustive, but they have two sons. They have Jacob, Yaakov, and Esau. I guess that's how you say it in English. I actually have no idea how you say it in English. Esav, the older son, is a man of the fields. He's a woodsman. He's a hunter. Represents brute physical strength. And Jacob is described as a person who stays in tents, who learns Torah. In the rabbinic conception, Jacob is sitting in a yeshiva and learning. This Torah, this study of Torah, this Jewish mind that has been the thing that sustains us. And Jacob really is the progenitor of all of us, even though we come directly from Avraham. Our rabbis tell us that Jacob is the only one that mitato shlema. There was no Ishmael, there was no Yishmael, there was no Esav, there's no separate line. He marries two key wives, Leah and Rachel, They are sisters. And then he takes two concubines, Zilpah and Bilhah, and they have the 12 tribes of Israel. You can see them over here, the 12 tribes starting. It's arranged here in a strange way, but Reuben, if you could see my cursor, Reuven is the oldest, Shimon, Simeon is the second, Levi is the third, Judah is the fourth. Judah is in green because Judah becomes the progenitor of Jewish monarchy. And that itself is a whole discussion. The ignominious origins of Jewish monarchy comes from the assorted episode between Judah and his former daughter-in-law, Tamar. They have Peretz, and Peretz is eventually the line that leads to King David and eventually to the Messiah. These are the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph and Benjamin are the two sons and the only sons of Rachel, and the brothers conspire. We're going to skip ahead a little bit before we get to the Exodus. The brothers conspire against Joseph. Joseph is the youngest at the time, the favorite son of Jacob. And Jacob, there are some moves that you could look at and you could question from a modern parenting style. I hasten to say that psychologizing the patriarchs and matriarchs or really looking deeply into the psychology of any of these biblical figures is something that is fraught with challenge. We have to remember, you know, at least from a traditional perspective, these are the pillars of all humanity, the pillars of our people. And when the Torah chooses to recount sordid episodes, difficult episodes, episodes that we may read and might see as very hard to understand, why is it that Jacob would show such favoritism to Joseph? Why is it that if he knew that Joseph was antagonizing his brothers and his father with stories and dreams of ways in which he would rule above them, and that their stalks of wheat would bow down to his stalk of wheat in one dream, or that their stars would bow down to his star, even the moon, even his father as well. Why didn't Jacob stop his son, Joseph? Why didn't he tell him, hey, chill out a little bit? But this story is probably most famous because of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's got great songs. We used to listen to it in the car as well, so you probably know this story. But the brothers conspire to throw, initially first to kill him, and then they sell him down to Egypt. They sell him down to Egypt, and the way that the story plays out is that Joseph, who is destined for greatness, rises to power in Egypt. Joseph goes from a jailhouse dream interpreter to the leader, the second in command of all of Egypt, saving Egypt from a famine. And because of the famine in the ancient Near East at the time, the brothers are forced to come down. The brothers come down to Egypt. They do not know that it is their brother Joseph who has arrested them on trumped up charges of spying. And then Joseph finally reveals himself to them and says who he is. One of the most poignant, amazing episodes, Ani Yosef Aod Avichai. I am Joseph, is my father still alive? You know, and Aod Avinu Chai in the song Am Yisrael Chai, that's where it comes from, right? Our father is still alive. It's a reference to Jacob. It's a reference to Joseph. And as the Jews settle in Egypt, this might sound familiar. They have a privileged neighborhood named Goshen. Some of the Jewish people rise to very high levels in Egyptian society, especially the tribe of Levi. And this, again, these aren't fairy tales. The reason the Torah tells us these things is because these are stories that they happened and they happen again and again and again. You become an adult, you become more sensitive to the stories, and you realize the songs that our children sing, right? Dig, 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 dig your hammers deep, or you know, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, that kind of elided how horrific the infanticide of the Egyptians were, how horrific the conditions, how humiliating the conditions of slavery were. The Talmud says that the Egyptians waged psychological warfare on the Jews. They would give them impossible tasks, cities that would sink into the ground. They would give them, they would give males female labor, they would give the females male labor, and it was a project of wholesale humiliation that was going to wipe out the entire Jewish people. Our very beginnings, the Jew is forged. Our nation is forged in suffering, is forged in the crucible of slavery. And through that, we gain our very key identity. I was having a conversation with my brother recently, and we were talking about the state of things and, you know, how to relate to the suffering that we've witnessed in Israel, and how to relate to that. And we said something that I think is very true, that the life of the Jew, at least male Jew, but all Jews, the life of the Jew begins with the cut, begins with the circumcision, the covenant with God, begins with the scream of a Jewish baby being brought into the world, a male Jewish baby. And that scream, that primal that primal wail to God is something that is part of our DNA, because the redemption comes because the Torah says they cried out to God. And they cry out to God and God sends Moses. Moses is a Jew who has been raised in the palace of the Egypt's, at the heart, at the belly of the beast. And Moses comes to Pharaoh, and Moses says to Pharaoh, famously, "Let my people go." We heard that yesterday a few times at the rally. Hearing Natan Sharansky, famous refusnik, say, "Let my people go," at the rally was a very powerful, maybe the most powerful moment of the rally to me. Hearing Ambassador President Herzog say it as well, "Let my people go," which has been a phrase that's unfortunately had to be repeated to get the Jews out from behind the Iron Curtain. "Let my people go." To get the hostages out of Gaza and return to their families, "Let my people go." And our beginning of a nation starts with "Shlach et ami ve'avduni," send my nation forth so that they could serve me, serve God. The Jewish people are saved from their slavery by a series of 10 plagues, miracles that happen. I asked my AI, ChatGPT, to give me an image of locusts. This one is pretty scary. And I also asked ChatGPT to give me an image of the Jewish people crossing the sea. It's not quite great, but you get the idea. An entire nation, after 10 plagues, finally culminating with the plague of the death of the firstborn, they leave Egypt with just the belongings on their back, the reparations that they've taken from the Egyptians, and the bread does not even have time to bake on their way out, and they leave Egypt. That is the story of the Exodus. God brings them from the Exodus to receive the Torah. There's one point to the Exodus, which is revelation and theophany at Sinai. This is an etching from the 17th century. Both, this is from AI. I just chose it because it looks really cool. But this image is as good an image as you could have of what the revelation at Sinai was like. Moses went up to the top of the mountain, learned the Torah. The Torah was taught to Moses over a period of 40 days and 40 nights. The mountain was ashan kulo, smoking. There was thunder and lightning around the mountain, and the entire nation stood and received the Torah. The entire nation said, as our rabbis say, na'aseh v'nishma, we will do it and we will hear it. Full acceptance of the Torah, of its commandments, of the covenant that was forged. At this point, you could say that they finally become the Jewish people. Before this, there is a nation, the Ivrim. There are the Hebrews, there are the patriarchs and matriarchs who themselves don't even have a necessarily full Jewish status. It's at this point of revelation of the Torah that the Jews receive full status of the Jewish people. The nation receives the Torah. According to different rabbinic accounts, they receive either only the Decalogue, only the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, or they receive the entire Torah. Even the Torah that we would be speaking tonight is received at Har Sinai and Mount Sinai. And the people, unfortunately, right at Mount Sinai, have a paroxysm of idolatry. Old habits die hard, and they serve a golden calf. And that is a moment that instead of rising to this level of creation that was at the giving of the Torah at Sinai, there was a tremendous failure with the serving of the golden calf. Moses shatters the first tablets and has to go up again to receive a second set of tablets, a second set of luchot, and the Jews travel on from there. They are doomed to travel in the desert for the next 38 years. This leads us to the next period in Jewish history, which is after the wandering in the desert, which we're just kind of going to skip over right now. They are supposed to go. And you can look at this map over here. Sandy, can you see my cursor? I just see that you have your screen on. So I'm just going to mark with my cursor. If this is a good map, this comes from the Da'at Mikra, Tanakhs, that have maps. You could see over here, this is the land of Egypt. This is the Mediterranean Sea. This is the Jordan River, just in case you're ever chanting from the river to the sea, which I hope you're not, but now you know exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if you guys saw those videos of them going around to people and saying, "Which river, which sea?" And people are like, "Oh, I don't know." So then why are you chanting it? You don't know anything about this place. So now you know this. You know about this place. This is the Jordan River, and this is the Mediterranean Sea, and this is the Yam Suf. All right, so this is the... This is the Red Sea over here, the Gulf, the Red Sea, and we have Egypt. So you could see the different red lines over here are the different opinions of how the Jews crossed into the Sinai Desert over here and how they made their way into Israel. The one that we're going to follow, the account that we're going to follow, leads us over here. They cross the sea over here at the top of it. They cross it, and they go all the way around. They go all the way around through Edom and to Moab and to Ammon, and they cross over into the land of Israel at the right at the top over here. They cross over into Israel after defeating these armies and the giants that led those armies, Sihon and Og. They cross into the land of Israel, another splitting of the river that happened in the days of Joshua, and they cross into the land of Israel. They were supposed to go like this. They were supposed to go straight into the land of Israel. Unfortunately, they sent out 12 spies, 10 of whom said that the mission is impossible and we cannot go into the land of Israel. And God turned to them and said, "Pnu sulachem amidbara," turn around and go back into the desert. And they were doomed for that generation to die out. So this is the path that we're going to follow. They come all the way around. If you've ever taken that bus ride down to Eilat, you've seen Hare Adom, you've seen these mountains on the, probably if you're going down, then you're seeing it out the left side of your bus. Unbelievable sunsets. Here's the Dead Sea. And Joshua crosses after the death of Moses, who's buried somewhere around here where my cursor is, overlooking the land of Israel. Moses does not get to go into the land of Israel. One of the great shockers of the entire Torah is that the hero doesn't make it in. And I remember somebody was telling me once, somebody who decided to read the Torah on their own for the first time. And they came to me, they were reading it in successive parts, and they were literally shocked. It's like watching Lahavdil, to distinguish between that and a TV show. It's like watching a TV show for the first time and being like, oh my gosh, the hero doesn't make it in. They get killed right at the end. And it's a shocker. Moses does not get to enter into the land of Israel. He dies with the rest of his people. One of the most poignant things, it says that Moses prayed to God 515 times to be led into the land, and God says, no, it will be Joshua. Interestingly enough, it's not Moses who ends up, it's not Moses or his descendants who end up leading the people. You would think that one of Moses' two sons would inherit the position from Moses. It's not the case. Instead, leadership passes to his disciple, to his student, Joshua. Joshua crosses. So I'm going to look at this map over here. Joshua crosses after they've defeated Edom and Moab and Ammon over here. So then they cross over. Where is Jericho? There's Jericho right there. They cross over basically right over here. The first place that the Jewish people encamp after they cross over the Jordan River is Gilgal. That's the first place. They erect 12 stone tablets on there and write the Torah on it. There are 2.5 tribes that end up inheriting portions on the Transjordan on the other side. You have Menashe, Gad, and Reuben. Half the tribe of Menashe, the tribe of Gad, and the tribe of Reuven. They stay here. They forge a deal that they're going to be like the commando forces. They're going to lead the fight in conquering the land of the seven nations who lived here previously, the Canaanite nations. And they asked to go back to the other side. They have lots of flocks and there's good grazing land. I'm seeing now already that I did not necessarily budget enough time to give an entire history of the Jewish people. I'll beg your indulgence, but I think that what we're going to probably do, we still have a little bit more time. What we're probably going to do is we're going to extend the series maybe by one class. Obviously, nobody is enjoined or duty bound to show up, but I'll be teaching it. They cross over into the land of Israel. And when they cross over into the land of Israel, there is a division of the land. Joshua actually divides the land. I'll just open the door for my wife. Joshua divides the land through the 12 tribes. And you can see that the way that the land is divided is that you have these 2.5 tribes on the Transjordan. You have, and you can see roughly where modern Israel would map onto it. You have Jerusalem. I'll maybe show you this really cool thing. Jerusalem is right over here. Yerushalayim is right here. And you have the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Binyamin. And the map tells the whole story. The Talmud tells us that the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, which we'll talk about probably in the next class, the temple lay just on the fault line between these two tribes. That there was a part of the city that was shared by Binyamin and Judah, by Benjamin and Judah, and the two tribes that eventually, after the kingdom is split between the northern and southern kingdoms, something we'll talk about in the next class, they form the kingdom of Judah, which is in the south. If you look up over here, you have Menashe, this would be Haifa, and you have here the Kinneret, what would be the city of Tiberia, that's in the tribe of Naphtali, and then you have Asher over here, Asher goes all the way up into what is now what is essentially now Lebanon, parts of Tyre and Sidon are part of that. And then you notice over here where Gaza is at this time, it's eventually conquered. Where Gaza is the land of Plishtim, and they are constantly a thorn in the side of Judah. At this time, there's the kingdom of Gat. This is where Goliath, the giant Goliath, comes from. And the last thing I'll point out about the story that the map tells us is that you have the tribe of Shimon. I forgot the name of that country. There's a Lesotho, I think, that South Africa landlocks another country within it. I think it's Lesotho. But Shimon is here. There's a reason for that. It's because Shimon and Levi are seen as, they're seen by their father as having done something thuggish by wiping out the city of Shechem. They also are the people. They're also seen as Jacob says in their blessing, you know, save me from their counsel. Levi shows that they're dedicated to Moses because they arrive on Moses' side when Moses says, "Mi LaHashem Elai, who is to God with me?" After the sin of the golden calf, the Levites become the stewards of the temple. The Kohanim is a subfamily of the Levites. They become the stewards of the temple and its service. There are a number of cities that are apportioned to the Levites, and they don't get an actual portion in the land of Israel. They have no land because their job is spiritual pursuits. They're not meant to be involved in this kind of work. And Shimon, on the other hand, who is seen as incorrigible, and that there's always the threat of violence. So Shimon is completely landlocked by the tribe of Judah, who are seen as the most powerful of the tribes. You also notice that in biblical Israel, at least in the beginning, there were separate conquests, and we're going to get to them later. This is after the first division, that what we would call the Negev, what would basically be like Be'er Sheva, which is right over here. Much of the Negev and Eilat would not be part of the initial conquest of the land. There's going to be a second kibush, and there's going to be other conquests of the land that add territory, including the Eretz Plishtim and including the Arzot HaNegev. I'll just give you a little bit of a preview. Next class, we're going to learn about the period of the Shoftim, of the judges, their wars, the tabernacle. This is the tabernacle superimposed upon a modern picture of Shiloh. Shiloh is a town in Samaria, where there's even a modern-day reconstruction of the tabernacle. And we're going to learn about the Beit HaMikdash and the kings. We'll also talk about Jewish dispersion routes after the destruction of the temple. Where did Jews go? Where did they begin the initial diaspora? Where did that start out? After that, we'll talk about the expulsions and the settlements of Judaism in history, the division of Ashkenazim and Sephardim, two distinct Jewish halachic groups. And then we're going to make our way into modernity. We'll talk about Zionism a little bit, and then hopefully that will be it for the history. I apologize we didn't cover all of this tonight, but what I do want to say is that I